Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the America Indian Foundation and Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Sundari Mitra. It is my pleasure to introduce Carl Pope, co-author of Climate of Hope, How Cities, Businesses, and Citizens Can Save the Planet. Carl is widely recognized as a leading climate change and environmental advocate. He spent nearly 30 years at the Sierra Club, where he served as executive director and chairman. Carl graduated summa cum laude from Harvard University and served in the U.S. Peace Corps for 2 years. He sits on numerous boards, including the National Clean Air Coalition, California Common Cause, and the California League of Conservation Voters. Carl is also a member of the U.S.-India Track 2 Climate Diplomacy Project. He is now the principal advisor at Inside Straight Strategies and a senior climate advisor to Bloomberg. Moderating tonight's conversation is Brady Walkinshaw, who is the CEO of GIRST. Brady has devoted his entire career to justice and sustainability issues. As a Fulbright scholar, he founded a nonprofit in Honduras and also worked for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He also served in the Washington State House of Representatives. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Carl Pope and Brady Walkinshaw.
I'm delighted to be here with someone I just have tremendous admiration and respect for, Carl Pope, and have for a long time, and thrilled to get to be here invited by the American India Foundation and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley to help engage in this important conversation about what in my mind is the most important issue of our time. So I wanted to just kick it off and let Carl speak for a bit about his book, which there'll be a book signing on after this, which I read, and it struck me as very optimistic, and optimistic in these times, optimistic with the federal government that we have today, and optimistic, I think, around different ideas for what is driving change and progress on climate and clean energy and the role of cities. And I just thought he was sharing some interesting stories with me behind the stage that the title about a climate of hope was not the original title of the book. So I thought you might kick off and introduce yourself and share a bit more.
Well, it's great to be with you, and it's great to be here with AIF, an organization that I've worked with for years and my wife has worked with for even more years and even more closely and that I admire greatly. So I know a lot of you here are AIF stakeholders, and I wanted to thank you for what you do, and I want to welcome everybody else. When Climate of Hope was in Galley, when what a friend of mine likes to call the occurrence took place, and Donald Trump was going to be our next president. And we had not anticipated this. And we had to decide what to do about the book, and when you're in Galley, you can't do much. So we made some very modest changes in the introduction, and we changed the title, because the original title was Overheated. And our point was that people were talking about climate change as this cosmic, overwhelming, impossible, one of the phrases people used was super wicked problem. And Mike and I actually thought climate change, while it's extraordinarily dangerous and important, isn't really a problem. It's a symptom of a series of problems. And if you go behind the symptom and look at each of the problems that contribute to it, it is a problem that people have faced before, know how to solve, and have solved. Now, there's more than one. So you can't just solve for one thing. If we eliminated fossil fuels completely, if tomorrow nobody ever burned another calorie of fossil fuels, 40% of the world's climate problem would continue unabated, because fossil fuels are only 60% of the problem. Carbon is only 40% of the problem. The rest of the fossil fuel problem is actually methane. So that was the original title, and after the election, Mike and I sort of looked at each other and we said, Nobody's going to care about that anymore. People need hope. So then we just played around with various versions of hope and came up with Climate of Hope. And when the book came out, and we were doing interviews and media appearances and readings and the things you do after a book comes out, it became quite clear that hope was all people wanted to talk about. We never actually got, in the first 3 or 4 months after the book came out, we did a lot of press. We never really got into the content of the book at all. We just got into, how can you be hopeful? I mean, I remember I did one interview on WNET in New York, and the host just kept saying, no, really? No, let's go back. How can you be hopeful? So I'll start out, and then I'll turn it back to you by saying, Mike and I were hopeful because we looked at this problem from the bottom up. We didn't think that what really mattered was what governments decided. We decided what really matters was what the economy did. And we were watching what the economy was doing in the lead up to Paris. And we saw the economy changing very rapidly, and changing rapidly for reasons which actually had relatively little or nothing to do with concerns about climate change. People didn't want to breathe polluted air. And at that point, when we wrote the book, it was an article of faith that India and China would build hundreds more coal-fired power plants from 2015 to 2020. And the Chinese, even in Paris, only promised to peak their emissions in 2030. They actually accomplished it in 2018. They're now in the business of retiring coal-fired power plants. The government of India announced last week that it will not permit any new coal mines going forward. No coal mines that are not already in the permitting process will ever be opened in India. They're getting ready to shut down a bunch of coal power plants. Saudi Arabia, which you can just imagine, the Saudis are really, I mean, they should be very upset about climate change. Their country is going to be close to unlivable if it gets much hotter. But they have a lot at stake, and in spite of the fact that they have a lot at stake in keeping fossil fuels alive, they have just commissioned the world's, I believe, cheapest ever source of electricity, which is a solar power plant which will deliver electricity for 1.8 cents a kilowatt hour. That is about 10% of what you pay if you live in Palo Alto.
So one of the things, I say this as someone who, I think for a long time before I started working full-time on environmental issues, struggled with climate depression. Just thought, you know, how can you be hopeful in a situation when the path to averting a 1.5-degree world is very hard to imagine what that means, what that change means. And it actually means pretty rapid change. And one of the theses that I read out of Carl and Mayor Bloomberg's book was that the market forces, particularly in the energy sectors, and also what's happening in cities, are going to continue irrespective of what may happen in the federal government. And that those forces in some ways have reached, I don't want to say a tipping point because that means other things, but have reached a certain momentum that is hard to reverse. And I wonder, and I think about this a lot, is that kind of change fast enough? Is that do you see that kind of market-led kind of transition or that push or that innovation in cities? Are you concerned about the pace of change?
Well, I'm very concerned about the pace of change, but I think, again, you have to stop thinking about this as a problem with a pace of change. Let us take what for years was what everybody worried about, which was the electric sector. The pace of change in the electric sector is plenty fast. The pace of change in the electric sector is going to run coal power plants all over the world over. Anybody who builds them will lose their money. Anybody who invested in coal companies when Mike and I started writing Climate of Hope, has now lost 90% of his money. So in the electric sector, it's not done, but you can just see the trajectory. You draw the curve. You just draw the curve of the last 3 years, and it's all over. Then you say, that's not the whole problem. Then you say, okay, what about transportation? Well, as a result of progress in the electric sector, transportation is now the biggest source of carbon dioxide pollution. It didn't used to be. Electricity used to be. And it's still true. very few of this year's cars are electric. But if you look at the numbers and you look at the costs, you know, we now have, you know, auto manufacturers debating whether they're going to have 30% or 50% of their vehicles electric by 2030. That is just like, that means it'll be much more than that, because they're always conservative. And so we can see the trajectory in the electric sector. Agriculture, the work has not begun. There's an enormous amount of very important work to be done in the agricultural sector. It hasn't begun. If I really worry about the pace of change, that's probably the place I worry the most, because nothing's happening. But it's not that we don't know what to do. And then a signal success story for climate diplomacy, which has not accomplished that much, is refrigerants, HFCs, these chemicals that we began to deploy to save the ozone layer but turned out to be phenomenally effective at cooking the climate. And at Kigali in 2015, the entire world agreed to phase them out. I mean, one of the six major climate pollutants will be gone from the Earth by 2030. So there's a lot of progress there, but then if you look at agriculture, not much happening. But on the other hand, we don't need any fancy new doodads in agriculture, and we don't need to spend any more money. Globally, we're already spending $500 billion telling farmers what to do. And right now, we're spending $500 billion on subsidies that tell farmers to grow cotton, corn, and soybeans that nobody needs. If we spent $500 billion telling farmers to store carbon and water that we do need, farmers would be just as happy. Farmers don't really care what they grow what there's a market for. We've created an artificial market for corn syrup, we've created an artificial market for cotton. If we got rid of that and created an artificial market for storing carbon in the soil, Midwest farmers would be glad to put their tractors away and not plow the ground, and that would make an enormous difference. Midwest farmers would be happy to buy less nitrogen fertilizer. Indian farmers would be happy to use balanced fertilizer that would increase their yields instead of being paid by the government, as they currently are, to use so much nitrogen fertilizer that they actually hurt their yields. So, again, there are a lot of problems. We need to solve them quickly. But solving each one makes us better off, not in 30 years, makes us better off right now.
So let's travel to India for a moment in the context of the discussion tonight. I mean, one, you talk about farmers. I mean, I think one trend that we're all wrestling with is that as countries grow wealthier, you see diets diversify, you see greater demand for meat. And, you know, India's is ground zero in terms of dietary diversification and demanding kind of more complex proteins that are difficult to produce and require a larger kind of methane and carbon footprint. One thing I wanted to ask is kind of in the context of this evening here, maybe talk about, maybe even stepping further back, how your book kind of applies in the context of other governments and other countries, particularly India, that need to be partners in tackling climate change.
Well, let's put food aside. I mean, we'll get back to it, but let's go to India first. I mean, one of the things that is extremely important to understand is that in a place like India, climate is not created by economic development. The climate problem, the major Indian contribution to the climate problem, is not the result of the fact that India has more cars than it used to. It does. It is not the result of the fact that India has more electricity than it used to. It does. The biggest impact India has on the climate is that there are roughly 600 million people cooking on cow dung, charcoal, twigs, and biomass. That is actually the biggest contribution India makes to the world's climate problem, is the black carbon that comes off of cooking on biomass. That is also the source of half of India's air pollution. You've read about how horrendous the air pollution in Delhi is. Most of that air pollution does not come from cars and trucks and power plants. It comes from farmers burning fields and it comes from women burning cow dung. And that kills an enormous number of people. It probably kills 350,000 people a year in India, breathing it outdoors. And if you look at what happens to the women and children who are in the kitchen, in most of India, if you are a poor woman cooking on biomass, the odds are 1 in 10 that you will die of cooking. Now, that's not a problem of development. That's not a problem of modernization. That's not a problem of prosperity. That is a problem of failed development. That is a problem of uneven modernization. That is a problem of leaving certain populations mired in poverty rather than advancing them into prosperity. And the solution to this problem is quite simple. Poor women in India should cook on what we cook on, gas. Ideally, the gas should come from biomass, but actually it would be much better to take all the natural gas liquids which are currently being flared by American oil companies and European oil companies in Africa and turn that into cooking fuel for poor women in Africa and South Asia. And the climate would be much better and people's lives would be phenomenally better. But we haven't prioritized including these populations in development. And so the narrative in India about climate is not, I mean, the Indians have the conventional narrative. The Indian government goes to these international conferences and say, we're not going to have our development held back. You guys created the climate problem. We shouldn't have to slow down our development. And indeed, they should not. We need for them to speed up their development process. We need them to get people, instead of lighting with kerosene, they need to be lighting with electricity. Instead of building old inefficient power plants, they need to be building modern solar and wind, which is cheaper. Instead of cooking on biomass, they need to be cooking on clean gas. So there's a whole conventional frame on the climate problem that came from the United States and Europe and which is being incorrectly applied in places like Africa and India. And it's very important to get out of that frame, to look at the problem as it really is. If half of the climate pollution comes from biomass cooking, do something about biomass cooking. And that's definitely going to require making people more prosperous, or at least making their lives better off.
So this is probably a question that you've had before, which is asked, I think, whenever they're co-authors of a book. But what are some places that you disagreed? Were there issues when you were writing, then you were thinking about the future of our, you know, the climate of hope, as it were, where you disagreed?
I'll tell you the marketing secret behind the book, which is that when we set out to write it, and this the idea for the book came from Mike's chief staff, a friend of mine named Kevin Sheeky, and Kevin said, look, you and Mike actually agree about almost all this stuff, and we do, and I'll get to what we don't agree about in a minute. He said, but nobody's going to believe that. So if we write a book that you two wrote together, everybody, oh my God, let's watch the sparks fly. And you've read the book, so you know there aren't very many sparks. Because Mike and I started out with this perspective, let's break this problem down into its pieces and let's see what the pragmatic solution is to each of the pieces. And if you do that, it turns out he and I both share the fundamental perception that, as Mike likes to say, everything we have to do to solve the climate will make us either richer, healthier, or safer now. This is not about a trade-off of the future against the present. It's a trade-off about, well, would you rather have a lower utility bill? Would you rather have no utility bill? Right now, there's really no reason for any house anywhere in the world to be built that requires a utility bill. We now know how to build houses that don't need heating and cooling, that cost no more than a house that has a big utility bill. So would you like not to have a utility bill? What's not to like about not having a utility bill? So we agreed on that. Where do we disagree? About some of the steps along the way. Mike believes that nuclear power has a larger role in the next 20 years than I do, and not because he and I have fundamentally different attitudes about the safety of nuclear power, but I've watched the nuclear industry closely for many years, and I do not believe they're capable of building a power plant that's competitive. I just don't believe they can make it economically. Similarly, although Mike has changed on this, when we wrote the book, Mike was still somewhat bullish on natural gas, and the reason was that he had helped clean up New York City by replacing fuel oil on the Upper East Side with natural gas. So he'd seen that natural gas can have some pretty important air pollution benefits, which it can. I was more aware at that point of the fact that, once again, I think you could have natural gas be part of a medium-range solution if you had an industry that was producing natural gas that wanted to be responsible. But unfortunately, a significant part of the natural gas industry doesn't, in fact, want to be responsible, and that makes it really impossible to rely on natural gas as an interim kind of step. So mostly we're going to have to get off gas as well, and we're going to have to get off gas sooner because the gas industry won't produce it cleanly.
So I'm going to turn to a question. There's audience questions I'm going to sprinkle into this. So if you have a question, they'll come on up to me. But this is an interesting one. This is actually something that Bill and Melinda Gates released their annual letter today, and they do this every year, and they actually talked about climate change in it a fair bit. And this is one of the questions that it's an interesting question. So, and I think it's one that's frequently asked, and this is, which is the greater threat to the planet, climate change or overpopulation? And maybe it's a false question, false division.
Well, first of all, just to give you a little context, my connection with AIF originates with my connection with my wife, who is from India, and my connection with my wife originates in the fact that 50 years ago, I spent 2 years in a village in eastern India distributing condoms. So I was working on the population problem a long time ago. And again, I would say that my understanding of that problem at that time, and I was admittedly only 24 years old, so I forgive myself, was really quite inadequate. Both the climate problem and overpopulation have a common main source. The real threat to the planet is our refusal to empower women. If you look at what's happening around the world, where women have their hands on the tiller, we're kind of moving in sort of an okay direction, a better direction. Where women don't have their hand on the tiller, it sucks. It's really quite simple. In the case of population, that's because if you don't empower women, they have children they don't want to have, because they don't have opportunities. And those children don't get educated if they're girls, and the cycle continues. If you look at climate, women are much less tolerant of being poisoned than men. Men actually think it's kind of manly to be poisoned. And real men don't use solar panels. I mean, that's sort of what you can sense in the Trump administration. It's not manly to sit back and let the wind generate your power. You ought to be shoveling coal. Donald Trump has shoveled a lot of coal in his life, right? So the evolution on these things is really all about empowering women. So I would say that is a false question because they're both symptoms of a failure to empower women. And that was an appeal to audience. I thought I'd get an applause for that.
That merits an applause. So I thought you spent decades leading one of the most important environmental organizations in our country, and I would say in the planet. And I think just to kind of fast forward, I thought I would ask a question more about the kind of the state of the environmental movement today. And I was going to kind of touch on something that I have seen as kind of a divide, and I think that it may also be a false question in this way. But, you know, I think on one side you have had a belief that these technological and market-driven solutions have the ability, I think, over the long term to make the change, going back to pace of change, at the rate and the scale that we need to. And I think that you have another set of arguments out there that have broadly said that as we tackle climate, at the same time, this is also an opportunity to recreate an economy that is more equal. It's an opportunity to undo kind of elements of kind of our financial system. It's an opportunity to talk more about race and justice and kind of the environmental justice movement broadly. And I was just curious if you saw tension there, how you saw that playing out in our country. Do you think that tackling climate change in some ways has now taken on the need to in so doing, tackling wealth inequality, thinking about race and justice, and how you kind of see those intersecting movements, or do you see them intersecting?
Well, I guess I think there is a challenge facing the environmental movement, but it I don't think is the one that you identified, and I actually think the whole dialogue around environmental justice is in part a solution to this other dilemma. The environmental movement that I led part of for many years and that I grew up in had as its mission cleaning up the 20th century economy. It was a cleanup operation. It was going back on a bunch of things that had happened. Power plants and sawmills and cement plants and steel mills and automobiles and suburban development patterns that weren't very good for the air, the water, the soil, and people's health. So we were in a cleanup mode. And that mostly meant saying no to things. I mean, I led an organization that was phenomenally good at saying no. And most of the things we said no to would have been really bad things. I mean, we prevented the American aviation industry from committing itself to supersonic transports, and thereby, if you own airline stock and it still has any value, you can thank the Sierra Club. California in the 1980s was going to build 25 huge LNG importation terminals, which would have quadrupled your home heating bill had they been built, and we don't have that thanks to organizations like the Sierra Club. So we stopped bad things. That was good. When the Sierra Club in about 2004 began to wrestle with what we did about climate change, we came to a very sobering realization, which I think the environmental movement is still trying to absorb, which is there are already enough power plants and steel mills and cement kilns in the world to fry the climate. Stopping bad things is no longer a viable answer. You have to accelerate good things. You have to replace all that stuff with new stuff. Everything the United States has built in the last 200 years needs to be renovated or replaced in the next 30. This has got to be a building century, not a slowing down century. We have to accelerate. And that, for traditional environmentalists, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around. We got very good at one thing, and now we're being asked to do, because the world changes, something quite different. I think the environmental justice movement is also about undone work. It's not about stopping things. It's about giving communities on the eastern side of the Central Valley some kind of transit so they don't have to buy and drive polluting 15-year-old inefficient SUVs. So it's about giving everybody access to stuff that's much better than the stuff I grew up with. I did not grow up impoverished. I had access to the American dream, and the American dream was full of crappy stuff. As we replace that crappy stuff, we have to make sure that everybody has access to it, or it won't work from a climate point of view. So I actually believe that, you know, and this is most dramatically obvious internationally. I think we're going to solve the climate problem, and I think the country that's going to lead us, that's probably going to lead us the most aggressively in solving it, is probably China. And China is not going to lead us aggressively because of the climate. They're going to lead us aggressively because they want good stuff. They don't want to be heating their homes as they do in Hebei right now with old coal-fired stoves. They would like to have homes that the windows don't leak on. And I would like them to have those homes. And if we don't get them those homes, we're in a world of trouble.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
That's great. I couldn't agree more. That's a great answer. I'm going to turn back to something you started bringing up as we wait for more questions to come up from the audience, but the food sector, to kind of go back to, and talk a little bit about food and consumer behavior and places that if we look at different sectors that are emitting carbon or methane, if we feel like we have energy, if we feel like energy is headed broadly in the right direction, if you feel like transportation, is the
electricity
next frontier.
Electricity
headed broadly in the right direction. Right. Transportation being a future frontier.
Right.
I agree. I think food is maybe even backsliding in ways in how we look at the way that agriculture and our food system is contributing to emissions. And do you see other than kind of cutting back on subsidies, should meat cost three times as much? I mean, how do you think about?
Well, let me say, and I said in the opening chapter of the book on food, the book is organized around the way we live our lives. There's a section on how we get around for transportation. Yeah. There's a section on how we live for cities. There's a section on how we invest.
There's
a section
on
how we make stuff. Yeah. And there's a chapter on food. Yeah. And at the beginning of the food chapter, I conceded that it was the one chapter that I most spectacularly missed my deadline on. I kept procrastinating about writing it, and the reason was that the topic of people's diets as a climate solution, it just boggles my mind, because I don't believe people are going to change what they eat because of the climate. I think there are many ways in which people should change what they eat, and everybody probably needs to change the way they eat in a different way. But I happen to love a really ecologically terrible food, shrimp. And I keep periodically trying to eat less shrimp. I relapse. When I was in my village in India, we had a cholera epidemic, and one of the staff people in the health clinic I worked in actually got cholera and died of it. Now, even at that point, people weren't supposed to die of cholera if they got medical care. And so the doctor who ran the clinic and for whom this guy worked was really very flipped out by the fact that one of his own staff people had died of cholera. And I was trying to be reassuring, and I said to him, well, but he was really old. And the doctor looked at me and said, no, he was about 45. I said, and my jaw dropped. I said, well, why did he look so old? Because the guy looked much, much older than 45. And he said there had been a famine. This was in the state of Bihar, and there had been a famine in the previous 2 years. And during the famine, the United States sent millet and sorghum as food grain supplies, and there was actually enough food in the markets, but there was no rice. Because the rice crop, no rain, no rice. And he said, this guy was a member of a caste that only ate rice. And so he starved himself during the famine, and that was why he looked so old. And that to me is sort of an emblem of the fact we are deeply, deeply committed to the way we eat. It's a very personal thing. I don't think we're going to change people's habits. Fortunately, we can greatly reduce the impact of the food sector without changing our diets, with one exception. There's one thing, and this is bad news for anybody from Argentina in the room, there's one thing that we really need to not do, and that is adopt the hamburger habit. Beef is really bad, and we don't know how to make cows that don't burp, because that's how they digest their food, so it's unlikely we'll ever be able to solve that problem. Beef is overwhelmingly the single villain. If you want to say, what's a food that's bad for the climate? Beef is bad for the climate. That's true. And corn-fed beef is the worst for the climate, because cows are not meant to eat corn, and when you give them corn, they get sick, and when they get sick, they belch even more. And then you have to give them antibiotics. So there are lots of things. So yes, corn-fed beef we need to move away from. India's not likely to go that way. I don't think India is going to become a big consumer of corn-fed beef, however prosperous it becomes. So we could all actually learn something from India. And in fact, it turns out the difference between pork, which is what the Chinese are mainly adopting as they get more prosperous, the difference between pork and corn-fed beef, pork is about as climate bad as soybeans. It's not much worse than soybeans. So it's not really meat. And pork is better than milk for the climate because to grow milk, I mean, cows are involved in that process too. That's right. So, but let's leave diet aside for a minute. About half of the fruits and vegetables that are grown in the United States never get eaten. A quarter of them get thrown away on the way to your table, and about a quarter of them get thrown away after they get to your kitchen, but uneaten. So we, you know, without reducing our consumption of fruits and vegetables at all, we could at least reduce the impact of our fruits and vegetables by a third. You are encouraged, if you go to a grocery store in the United States by the United States Department of Agriculture, to throw away perfectly good food because the pull dates have actually been intentionally designed to confuse you so that you think you have to throw away food that you actually don't need to throw away. And if we fix the pull date system, some studies were done on this in the Midwest, we could save 15% of our food waste. Our food waste is incidentally 5% of our GDP is thrown away food. 5 cents out of every dollar in the American economy is wasted food. So there are a lot of things we can do, and that's why Mike and I keep saying, wait a minute, these are all going to make us, they're going to cut your grocery bill down. Wouldn't you like to have pull dates that actually told you when the food was still good? And if you did, you would save money and we'd save the climate.
With the exception of meat, red meat, cow meat.
No, cows. Not cows, meat, cows. Cows.
And dairy.
Cows and dairy is unfortunately, it's, I mean, you don't have to kill a cow, so it's got ethical, it definitely got ethical advantages over meat, beef, yep. But dairy's not so great.
So here's a good question, and keep these coming. This is a good one. So I'll just read it. Because following the money and voting with my wallet has always made sense to me, I support divestment as an important tool to hasten a just transition. The question is, do you support divestment? But I think more broadly, I think it's, you know, what do you think that the divestment movement is a tool to help move the needle on financial institutions?
I think the divestment movement has become very important, and I think it started out, and I wasn't at all sure it was going to get traction. I was skeptical. And the reason I was skeptical is because it started out with the argument that you should divest even though that was a bad investment strategy as an economic strategy. It started saying, yeah, you could make money by investing in Exxon, but you shouldn't do so anyway. And then it turned out it wasn't smart. It wasn't an economically good strategy to invest in Exxon if you're a long-term investor. And the divestment movement realized that, and they began talking about stranded assets and about the fact that, yeah, if you're a day trader, maybe you can make money on Exxon. But the target of the divestment community is university pension funds. It's your pension fund. Yeah. It's, you know, stock exchange traded things held by companies like Vanguard. The long-term investor is betting when he invests in fossil fuels that he will get out just in time. And anybody who advises you about long-term investments say don't time the market. But an investment in fossil fuels requires timing the market because fossil fuels are going away. And that's now clearly understood in the investment community. Fossil fuels are a short-term investment. They're going away. Coal will probably go away first. Natural gas will probably go away last. Saudi oil may be around for quite a while because it only costs $10 a barrel. Canadian oil at $60 a barrel, probably not around very much longer. So investing in fossil fuels is a bad investment as well as a bad moral statement. And therefore, I think the divestment community is getting huge leverage. And one of the interesting things is, and I didn't understand this at all when they started, when you say to investors, to institutional investors like CalPERS, which holds the California State Pension Funds, or Prudential Insurance Company. You say to them, divest. They say, no, we're not going to divest. At least that's what they said at first. But they said, but we will make the companies disclose what their risks are. And when the companies started having to disclose what their risks were, the investors looked at those companies and says, holy Jesus, this is not a good place to park our money. We're getting out. And Exxon has been under tremendous pressure, and finally, a month ago, came out with this very long report on what is the exposure of an Exxon investor to global action on climate change. And Exxon said, yeah, it's true. Right now we're using about 100 million barrels of oil a day. It's true. By 2040, we'll probably be using 36 million barrels of oil a day. Two-thirds of the world's oil goes away. But that's okay, because we'll still keep our, as long as we keep our market share, all the oil that we're carrying on our books as an asset will be needed, even in a 36 million barrel a day oil market. It's like, yeah, okay, but in a 36 million barrel a day oil market, there's 20 million barrels of Saudi and Kuwaiti $10 oil, and you've got a bunch of $50 oil. I don't think you're going to keep your market share, Exxon. And I actually think there are going to be some very interesting lawsuits about that disclosure. I think they've left themselves very open to challenges from the divestment community over the fact that they should have admitted there's no way they can keep their market share. Exxon should be spending itself out. Exxon should be pumping the oil it has and giving the money to its shareholders. It should not be investing the money in finding new oil, and they are refusing to do that.
So we have an election coming up in 2018, and then another one in 2020.
Yeah.
Which both of those I think will probably happen. And unless things go really off the rails. But assuming we have a 2018 and a 2020 election, I have been excited to see in a lot of Democratic primaries more candidates taking more outspoken positions on climate change, making it more of a campaign issue, making broader energy policy, committing to 100%. I mean, you see these commitments starting to happen in the governor's race in Colorado, the governor's race in Massachusetts, and hopefully others around the country. Are you hopeful in 2018? I mean, do you see that if we win in 2018, there could be some federal actions that are really meaningful that could happen? Or do you sort of kind of follow the thesis of part of the book, which is the federal government isn't quite as important as it could be?
I don't think, to be honest, that 2018, even if we have a tremendously successful outcome and, we have nothing but continuing resolutions for the last 2 years of the Trump administration because Congress can't pass anything he'll sign. It's quite possible. And then we get a Democrat in 2020. I don't think we're going to have the kind of majorities in the Congress that would be needed to make the federal government a climate leader. Because it's much easier to be a climate leader in a state, because every state has something it wants. It's interesting. There were some federal support programs for wind, for solar, and for batteries. And when the Republicans were passing their big tax bill, the Trump administration and the Koch brothers and the fossil fuel interests tried very hard to get rid of those. And they failed. And the reason they failed, they couldn't get rid of the tax credit for wind because Chuck Grassley from Iowa has a state that already gets 40% of its electricity from wind, and he didn't want it to go away. They couldn't get rid of the tax credit for solar because Jeff Flake from Arizona has a state that's going heavily solar, and Jeff Flake didn't want that to go away. And they couldn't get rid of the tax credit and the support for batteries because Dean Heller of Nevada has Elon Musk's gigafactory near Reno. And he didn't want that to go away. So what you're seeing is clean technologies are getting such strong footholds in states and cities that they're now, they have real economic power and they can't be rolled. And so it's much easier in that situation for a state to make its renewable portfolio standard bigger, for a state to join California in requiring that a certain percentage of the cars sold be electric vehicles, for a city to say, as San Diego has said, if you're Uber and you're Lyft and you want to use the San Diego airport, you have to do so with an electric vehicle. You can't drive a gasoline Lyft or Uber to the San Diego airport. So what you're going to see, I think, is after this election, a huge upspurring of state and city action that moves us forward. I don't think there'll be so much on the federal side, but I think the election will yield really important fruits in terms of the acceleration of the modernization of the American economy in a low-carbon direction.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. I mean, watching that, I live in Seattle, and we've had a very modest carbon tax marching through the Washington State Legislature that may well come to pass, and that would be under a government which is almost evenly split between Republicans and Democrats, almost evenly split. But I imagine there would be a question about Scott Pruitt. So here's the Scott Pruitt question. So I say this just as a reminder. I had a chance, two of the biggest pieces of federal legislation passed under the Nixon administration with Bill Ruckelshaus, a Republican EPA administrator with the Clean Air and the Clean Water Act. I just think it's important to remember that that's where some of those pieces of legislation started and how far we've gone to Administrator Pruitt. So the question is, I'm originally from Oklahoma, so I've followed Scott Pruitt's career for a long time. What are your viewpoints on how he's running the EPA, and what are you most alarmed by? What are you most alarmed by? we'll stop there.
That's a very, because of the most.
Yeah. What are you most alarmed about?
What am I most alarmed about? I think I'm most alarmed about the opportunity that he's going to have to basically give a lot of people who are breaking the law get out of jail free cards before he goes to jail, which he should. But he's going to pardon a lot of really bad actors in the process. And in doing so, I think it's important to understand that most sectors of the American economy have a lot of companies that do a terrific job of complying with environmental standards, and they have bottom feeders. They have companies that do a terrible job. And one of the functions of healthy capitalism is high-performing companies are supposed to beat poorly-performing companies. If you give poorly performing companies enough favors and benefits and get out of jail free cards, you interfere with that operation. And I think Scott Pruitt is going to slow down the modernization of the American economy quite dramatically, which in turn will make us much less competitive globally. So I actually think Scott Pruitt's biggest impact will be on the competitiveness of the U.S. economy in 10 years. He'll also, unfortunately, have a big impact on the health of the American people, and almost no impact on the climate. If you want to know why I think you'll have no impact on the climate, and you're the questioner who said he was from Oklahoma, so he or she probably knows this. While Scott Pruitt was in Oklahoma, when Scott Pruitt became Attorney General of Oklahoma, Oklahoma got 57% of its electricity from coal and 3% of its electricity from wind. When Scott Pruitt finished being Attorney General of Oklahoma and came to Washington to work for Donald Trump, Oklahoma got 23% of its electricity from coal and 32% of its electricity from wind. And Scott Pruitt, while he was Attorney General, fought that trend in every way he could. And he totally failed, not because the governor of Oklahoma was a fanatic believer in the urgency of solving climate change, but because, for example, people who operate oil refineries in Oklahoma like cheap electricity. They don't want to pay too much for electricity when you're operating. Oil refineries gobble a huge amount of electricity. So the oil refineries rolled Scott Pruitt in Oklahoma.
So I'm going to pivot for a second before asking a more general question. This is good. There's a couple questions in here about oceans and the health of our oceans. And one of them is about around trash and plastics in the ocean, and others around ocean acidification. When you think about our environmental health in the future, that is an area where kind of global action is important. And do you see leaders coming out that can actually lead in some of these ocean policy areas that we do need to take more collective action on that are less national governments?
Well, first of all, the oceans are in bad trouble, and they're in bad trouble in four ways. One of them is plastics. And it's quite simple. Plastic should not be something you throw away. It's an extremely valuable product, and we should have lots and lots of things made out of it, but they shouldn't be things that we throw away. And we actually can replace plastic in packaging with things that are made from plants and that will go back to becoming part of the soil. And if they get in the ocean, a fish can eat them and digest them, so they're food. And if you want to fertilize the food with your cornstarch-based packaging, well, it's wasteful, but God bless you, the fish won't mind. So we need to get rid of plastic packaging. Second big problem is overfishing. We are devastating the world's fisheries, and we are doing so because we refuse to set aside, probably if we set aside the right 15 to 20% of the world's oceans and said, not fishing here, not polluting here. This is where tomorrow's fish come from. Yeah. We could probably have, right now, about 1 billion people are dependent on fishing for their livelihoods, and we could probably have 1 billion people dependent on their fishing for livelihoods indefinitely. But unless we get on top of this business of setting part of the ocean aside and just saying, you know, the last 10% we're going to leave for the future. Third problem is, and you sort of, I want to come back to what you said, in addition to stopping the subsidies for agriculture are a big deal. They cause farmers to use far too much fertilizer, and that fertilizer mostly ends up in the ocean, and when it ends up in the ocean, it kills the ocean. So it's really important to pay farmers to do good things. And I'm a political realist. We're going to pay farmers. That's going to happen. That's the politics of democratic societies. So we're going to give farmers subsidies. I just want to give farmers subsidies to do things that make us all better off. And finally, which is the complicated one, which is ocean acidification. One of the things that isn't commonly understood is every year we put about 40 gigatons of carbon dioxide, 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the air. Only 20 billion tons stays there. 10 billion tons goes into the oceans, and 10 billion tons is absorbed by plants and soils on land. And if that didn't happen, if that 20 billion didn't get sucked out of the air, it would be 105 degrees in San Francisco every summer day. I mean, we would really have fried the planet already. It is the fact that the oceans are taking a quarter of our pollution that gives us the opportunity to fix this problem. But when that carbon dioxide goes into the ocean, it dissolves, it becomes carbonic acid, it makes the oceans more acidified, that makes it harder for marine life to live, that in turn can interfere with the ability of the oceans to absorb more carbon, but it also definitely messes up everything else about the oceans. So one of the reasons why it's urgent to actually solve the problem of our emissions of carbon, rather than saying, oh, let's wait until tomorrow and do some fancy geoengineering thing to fix it, something your magazine apparently recommended yesterday.
Not quite.
Published
an article
about
it.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. I had to get you.
With criticism.
but is because waiting until tomorrow to solve the carbon problem, even if it stabilizes the climate, will cook the oceans. So we've got to get on top of that.
You know, so that, I mean, that goes to kind of as we wrap up, I'd ask one more question from the audience. But, you know, what do you think? I mean, this is the question. I think we have unprecedented citizen mobilization. We had huge victories in Washington State around blocking two coal export terminals recently. You're seeing these sorts of movements really, I think, reverse the course of a lot of fossil fuel infrastructure, a lot of different areas where we're seeing successes. What do you think people should do? You know, when people want to think about how they act for a better planet in this country. I mean, it's vote. It's, you know, it's okay. this list of things. But what do you recommend?
The most important thing to understand is you are individually responsible for your collective action. That is your most important power. You now live in a world in which almost everybody in this audience, I don't know all of you personally, so I can't say this with huge confidence, but almost every one of you are a stakeholder in 5 to 24 institutions. You might belong to a neighborhood association, you may have an employer, you may be at a university or a school, you belong to a church or a book club. You are part of institutions. Every one of those institutions has an opportunity to make itself better off by helping the climate. Whoever, wherever you are institutionally connected, there are solutions available that will improve the bottom line of your company, that will make your university more attractive to the smartest students, that will help your neighborhood be cleaner and raise the value of your house, that will reduce your utility bill. And the key thing is to talk to people in those institutions and find out what you and they want to do together. It is what we do together. And it's not just about voting. I mean, I'm a big believer in voting. I'm a very political creature. Please do vote, but don't just vote. And one of the interesting things is that when I did book talks and there were lots of students there, I would get a question often from students about what can I do? You know? I'm just, you know, and they didn't want the answer, you can wait for 2020 and vote for somebody to replace Donald Trump. They didn't want to wait till 2020. And what I would say to them is, at your next job interview, be certain to ask the interviewer what his company is doing about sustainability and climate. Because we have a huge number of big, not terribly deeply morally troubled corporations that have decided, for example, to go 100% renewable. Anheuser-Busch, the makers of Budweiser. Anheuser-Busch did not go 100% renewable because the people who drink Budweiser are thinking about the carbon content of the electricity that ran the brewery. Most people who drink Budweiser don't think about the fact there's electricity in Budweiser at all, except to cool it. Budweiser does that because Budweiser wants to be able to hire the best employees. And they've discovered that, in fact, young people care. So if you care, all you have to do is care and then act with others, and you can solve this problem.
So I would also point you, every year the publication that I run publishes a 21-day apathy detox guide about citizen empowerment on climate. So it comes out in April around Earth Month, and it was just nominated for a National Magazine Award. So check it out, and that also helps to answer some of the questions that Carl is getting to. So last question of the evening. Very quickly, you've explained, I think, in extraordinarily great detail why you're hopeful, and I'm leaving this conversation hopeful. What do you see as the big barrier? Is a couple big barriers to us getting there? Not to leave on a dour note, but what do you see as the big barriers?
Well, I think there are two. One I've talked about a lot already, so I'll say it very quickly. It's a big barrier that people continue to believe this is about pain and sacrifice. And as long as people think it's about pain and sacrifice, they'll want to delay action. That's how we are. It's how we evolved. So it's accepted. Fortunately, and that's not always true. We have problems we face that are going to be about pain and sacrifice. This doesn't happen to be one of them anymore. The second thing that is very important to understand is that change can be very positive, but somebody's always left behind. If we don't take care of people who are left behind, They will fight change. They will slow us down. If we had a society in which people were insured, in the way that you're insured against the risk that your house burns down, if you were insured against the risk that your company would turn out to be on the wrong side of a carbon equation, and so you could still welcome progress because you were going to have a way to find something else to do. If we had that kind of society, we could probably double the pace with which we confront climate.
So on that note, thank you very, very much. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club. Thank you to our host here, our guest here, Carl Pope.
And thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.